This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is your typical radio ad while eating a Crunch Bar.
This is Automatic of Otto's Used Cars. This weekend only, we're having a whale! Bring the kids. See for yourself. It is huge. Gonna make a big splash. No other dealer can say they have a whale like this.
When things sound dull, turn up the fun with Crunch.
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
Hello and welcome to this special edition of Radio Astronomy from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. We're here at the Jodrell Bank to celebrate the Blue Dot Festival. I'm news editor Elizabeth Pearson.
And I'm the magazine staff writer Ian Todd.
Today, 50 years ago, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin set down on the surface of the moon, ready to go for their space work on the 21st of July.
That's right, and there's lots of kind of moon and Apollo-related stuff happening at this year's festival for obvious reasons. So we've been chatting to a few of the people who've been giving talks and lectures, talking about kind of Cold War space race and space junk and things like that. Earlier today, I spoke to Tim O'Brien, who's one of the associate directors here at Jodrell Bank, about the cutting-edge research that the observatory continues to do today, a bit about the history and a bit about the legacy of Apollo. So I am here at Blue Dot 2019 with Tim O'Brien, who's an associate director here at Jodrell Bank Observatory. Thanks very much for joining me, Tim.
No problem.
It definitely feels this year that Blue Dot is a lot busier. It feels like it's getting bigger. Do you think it is bigger. Do you think the word's spreading? Or?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you don't expect to immediately reach out to everybody who might be interested the first year you do it. So it's got to grow. You know, people got to hear about it. And we're certainly grown this year, so it's great.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people who are coming to Blue Dot for the first time might not be necessarily aware of what Jodrell Bank is and the history and things like that, or even just what this amazing structure behind us is. So I was wondering if you could talk a bit about the observatory and a bit about the Lovell telescope.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the observatory is well known for its radio astronomy work. So we look at radio waves coming from outer space with radio telescopes, and there's a bunch of telescopes here. But to be honest, probably most people's attention is on the big one. So the Lovell telescope that's sitting there behind us now is, when it was built in the 50s, it was the world's largest telescope. It's still the third largest telescope in the world, actually. So and you know, it's important to say that it's it's more powerful than it ever was, because although the mass of steelwork and the big paraboloidal reflecting ball is pretty much the same, we've been able to upgrade all the back end electronics. We're constantly changing the computers at the back, so the bit that sort of catches the radio waves and focuses them to the top of the tower in the middle, well, pretty much that stays the same, but you can do so much clever stuff now at the back end that we never used to be able to, so it's still really right there at the cutting edge.
Yeah, so what sort of things does radio astronomy enable us to see that, for example, optical light?
Yeah, I mean, when we first started looking at the universe with radio waves, we saw it looks completely different. You see a completely different view of the universe. You know, if you go out at night on a clear night and you look up at the sky with your eyes, you see stars. You see the hot surfaces of stars, maybe like the sun, 6,000 degrees, and they're glowing, they're visible. If you had radio dishes for eyes, you wouldn't see the stars. They're actually quite faint. But you see something that looks like stars, sort of points of radio light scattered over the sky. And those were originally called radio stars. We now know that they are the supermassive black holes at the hearts of distant galaxies, and they generate a huge amount of radio emission that we see right the way across the universe. And then sort of arching across the sky in the foreground, if you like, is the Milky Way. But again, instead of seeing the stars in the Milky Way, you see the stuff between the stars. You see radio waves coming from electrons that are spiraling around the magnetic field of the galaxy. So it's just, you know, the modern, you know, astrophysics is really like a jigsaw, where the jigsaw pieces are the different views that you get at different parts of the spectrum. So you get your visible light view, you get your radio view, you get your X-ray view. You put together those pieces, and then you make this complete picture of the universe.
And one of the things that British amateur astronomers often complain about is the horrendous UK weather and the clouds. But that isn't a problem for a radio telescope, is it?
No, not for us. Certainly, we work at centimetre wavelengths. So in that case, those basically travel through the clouds. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. I mean, I know normally it's lovely and sunny at Jodrell Bank, but it's a bit wet and grey at the moment. And yeah, we can see right through them. If you go down to the shorter wavelengths, so if you get down to the millimetre wavelengths, then water vapour is a problem. So millimetre telescopes will always be at altitude. So they'll be, you know, on the top of a high mountain, much like optical telescopes are. But at centimetre waves, we're okay from here.
You mentioned the weather, and it has been quite rainy this year. I mean, Previous years it's been absolutely amazing, and it's still nice and warm. But it kind of brings me on to something that we were talking about yesterday. We were just kind of having a chat, having a few beers outside our tent, and we were wondering what happens if the dish of the telescope fills up with rainwater.
Luckily, it doesn't fill with rainwater. It does actually have drain pipes. So there are drainage holes that the water runs out of, basically. However, the problem is snow, because the snow doesn't run out like the water does do. So it builds up in the bowl, and then we actually tip the bowl over. We make a little mini avalanche, and we tip this. So that's quite fun. It was 2011 maybe. It was a really cold winter. And it snowed, and it was so cold the snow froze to the surface of the dish, so you couldn't actually easily tip it out. So we had to rent in some gas burners that we had to put underneath the surface of the telescope to warm the surface of the telescope a bit, so we could then tip the snow out. So yeah.
And like when you're looking at it, it looks like there are like elevator shafts, and that you could actually get up to the top
of
the telescope.
Yeah. So there's lifts that go up either tower. There's two towers, one either side of the ball. And there is a lift in each tower. We have a green tower and red tower, which you can only really tell that's the case when you're inside. The floor is painted green in one and red on the other, so you know which side of the telescope you're on. And then you can sort of go out along a walkway to the middle, and there's a ladder that you can get up that gets into the main bowl of the telescope. But our engineers that work on the receivers that are at the top of a focus tower in the middle of the bowl, and that itself has its own lift. That's a much more compact and cosy lift that takes you to the top, that you actually have to get out the roof of. So that's quite a difficult procedure. So they have to be trained in rope access, you know, like professional climbing people are trained, so they can actually get to the focus.
As we're recording this, obviously it's the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11, and there's quite a lot of stuff happening this weekend at the festival. I mean, what sort of things could people expect tonight?
Oh, so tonight we're doing once it gets dark, we're doing a projection show on the telescope. So we have a group of artists called Illuminos that have worked on an Apollo 50th anniversary themed presentation that combines archive audio and video, and it sort of wraps around the whole of the telescope and tells the story of Apollo. So that's one of the major things we're doing. One of the things that's occupying my mind currently is the fact that we're going to do a moon bounce. So we're going to work with colleagues in the Netherlands with a telescope at Dwingeloo. which has a transmitter, and we're going to send messages and audio of various types, and even some images actually, send them live from here to Netherlands, where they get turned into a radio signal, transmitted to the moon, bounced off the moon's surface, and then we catch the echo as it returns with our other big telescope here, the Mark II, and we turn them back into audio or images, and we'll do that in real time. The round trip travel time is about 3 seconds, so you get the echo back quite rapidly because it all travels at the speed of light. But yeah, it's in principle, it's easy to do, but in practice, it's a bit technically demanding. So we'll see. It's a bit of a laugh. It's a bit of an experiment, and we like having a bit of fun here at Blue Dot.
Obviously, the Lovell telescope was named after Bernard Lovell. And I'm aware that kind of towards the end of his life, he was asked about Apollo, and he was slightly ambivalent, wasn't he? I mean, it was kind of the fact that he kind of saw it as just a kind of almost like kind of political prowess as opposed to actual science. Like,
But mainly that's true, right?
Yeah.
So he was right. the reason that it happened was a political competition between communism and capitalism, effectively between the USA and the Soviet Union. That's what led. That's why so much money was invested into it. Having said that, of course, the scientists were very keen to get some science out of it, and of course we have had masses of science out of the Apollo program and continue to do so. The lunar rocks that were brought back are still being analysed today. So it's not that it was not science at all, but the reason it happened was a political reason. That's why they decided to put so much money and so much effort into it, in fact. And it's also the reason why it really faded away after 1972, because once the race had been won, that political impetus sort of was not there anymore, really.
Yeah.
So although the scientists might have quite liked to go going back, they couldn't really persuade the governments to keep putting the money in. It's all going to change. It's all getting busy again. The moon's in the news again, and I'm sure we'll be back again with people very soon. By the end of the 2020s, certainly, possibly earlier. But I think by the end of the decade. I mean, I sound like JFK now, but and you shouldn't forget that we didn't. Although we haven't sent humans to the moon, we've continued to explore the solar system with robotic spacecraft, of course, ever since. So we've done huge amounts of science. It's just that we haven't put people beyond low Earth orbit.
Yeah.
Want to be more active this summer? Sierra helps you save on everything from swimsuits to stand-up paddle boards, tennis rackets to fishing tackle. And if that doesn't float your boat, we also have pool floats. Sierra, let's get moving. To your local store, like now. Go!
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at ikea-usa.com today.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
And just looking to the future, I mean, Jodrell Bank is the headquarters of a kind of cutting-edge new telescope that's kind of spanning continents, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we just opened the global headquarters just last week, actually, for the Square Kilometre Array, which is going to be built in South Africa and Australia. So many dishes in South Africa, many other antennas, aerials in Australia, and a global headquarters here. So that will be operating in, it'll take a while to get that up and running. It'll be another 10 years before that's running. But there are precursors for those telescopes already operating now in Australia and South Africa, Meerkat in South Africa and the Murchison Widefield Array in Australia, that are producing amazing science. And combine that with what we're doing already here with the eMerlin Array in the UK and the European VLBI network, there's a lot going on in radio astronomy, and I think our future here at Jodrell Bank is secure, I think, for at least the next 50 years.
Brilliant. Well, Tim, thanks very much for speaking to me today.
No problem.
Yeah, so I'm here with Chloe Penman, who is the documentary filmmaker. Hi, Chloe. Thanks very much for speaking to me.
Hello. How are you?
Yeah, Grant. We've just watched your film, How Britain Won the Space Race, which is about, it's really about the story of Jodrell Bank, I suppose, isn't it? And how it kind of got wrapped up in Cold War politics. How did you kind of come to this story?
Well, it was a kind of gift, really. It was I came to Jodrell Bank in 2014 with the BBC. We were making a documentary about the history of science fiction, and I'm from the West Country. I live in Bristol. I've never really spent much time in Manchester or the surrounding area. So, while you guys, you know, Jodrell Bank sort of like ingrained into your memory from like a child, like I'd never heard of it or even seen the telescope before. So I kind of arrived and it was like turning up to the set of some 1950s B-movie science fiction film, and like the way the control center still looks like a kind of 1950s. It's got all the kind of original fixtures and fittings. And as a massive science fiction nerd myself, it looked like something from Quatermass in the Pit or something. And I just thought, wow, what is this place? It's mental. It's amazing. And not only did it have this, you know, kind of heritage appeal, it also was still at the cutting edge of science. And so, you know, I found the whole place intriguing. But then I met Tim and Teresa, and that's when it kind of got really interesting, because I then got the full story about the man behind this sort of space age place. And it really was just an amazing human story. This guy, Bernard Lovell, turning up in a field after the Second World War with surplus sort of radar equipment and kind of inventing a new science. And not only inventing a new science, like erecting, at the time, what was the biggest radio telescope in the world, and I think even today is still the third biggest, and kind of nearly bankrupting himself in the process. I mean, it was just a ripping yarn. It was just a great story. And and Tim and Teresa not only had this sort of story to tell, they had, it was almost like an actual treasure trove, like an overflowing cupboard of like unseen archive photographs, 16mm film, 88mm film. So as like a kind of budding filmmaker, that was, it was like hitting jackpot. So I just felt like it was really important to get people to see this archive. And also I thought it was a really important story to tell. And as obviously this year it's got UNESCO World Heritage status, it continues to be a really important story for us to tell ourselves about Lovell and his telescope.
Yeah, I mean, after the film, we were kind of having one of those, you know, post-film chats and talking about it, and we just love how the story is kind of all, it's wrapped up in the kind of Cold War politics of the time.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of a bit crazy, really, how it all happened.
I know. I mean, it's this one place that obviously is dedicated to pure science, and I think somewhere in the film I say something along the lines of, you know, it keeps generating stories, like it's not just generating like data or evidence, like this place is like a storytelling machine, and almost all the key moments in the post-war period in terms of science and you know, global politics, Jodrell Bank sort of is involved in it in some way, and it's just kind of one of those amazing places, like kind of Venn diagram, like everything always links back. There's all Jodrell Bank's always kind of playing a role in these really important moments, and that's why I think it's such an enduring cultural icon as well as a kind of scientific one too. And I think that's why it has literally inspired storytellers, you know, not just me, many, many others.
Yeah, so I mean, I suppose one of the ways I kind of got caught up in the Cold War and the space race, really, which is what the film is about, was tracking the rocket that launched Sputnik. Do you think it's kind of a bit of a shame that it did kind of get caught up in politics? You know, because it was built to basically, you know, to look at the universe and discover how the universe was created.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting question. I think it's something that Bernard Lovell himself struggled with, and I think there's two sides to that coin. I mean, obviously, in the building of the telescope, Bernard Lovell incurred huge debt. I mean, he was hauled across the coals by the Public Accounts Committee. That's like having, you know, 25 MPs stand in front of you telling you you're making a huge mistake with public funds. And the key to unlocking the huge debt and shame that he'd incurred by building this, at the time, was a huge white elephant. It was like the Millennium Dome of the post-war period. I think showing that it had a purpose that could be outside of its original scientific, you know, remit, but had a purpose nonetheless. And actually tracking these intercontinental ballistic missiles was really, really important, especially during the Cuban Missile Crisis. So I don't think Lovell relished it being used by the military and the state, but actually, if that hadn't been used in that way, it might never have been finished, and he could have very realistically become bankrupt and sacked by the university. So, you know, swings and roundabouts.
You also have quite a lot of talking head segments from some of the residents who live in Cheshire.
Yeah.
I mean, so did you kind of speak to them? And how do you think the kind of local people view the Lovell telescope and Dodrell Bank?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I mean, what I'm really interested in as a filmmaker, and I make documentaries primarily about social history, so that's how I got, you know, I'm not a scientist, I'm a filmmaker who's interested in people and social history in Britain. And Time Shift, the strand that this was for, which was aired on, it's actually on iPlayer at the moment as well, if people want to watch it, is really about how, you know, normal people respond to huge moments in history or things. And actually, so for me, getting you know, testimony from someone like Margaret, who is amazing, and I mean she was in her 90s when we interviewed her, I think it just makes it, again, like these things feel so remote, and especially science and astrophysics, like, you know, I'm not a scientist, and these things can feel really rarefied, and that they're not about us, and they don't tell us about who we are as a society and as people. And I think, you know, above all, the Lovell telescope isn't just an instrument for, you know, the exploration of the universe. It's an important cultural landmark that gives people a sense of place, a sense of heritage. And those are all the reasons why it's got UNESCO World Heritage status today. And that's why it's really important to hear from people like Margaret. And the film ends with Margaret, you know, talking about how you only have to say Dodrell Bank and people know immediately where that is. And if it weren't for this place, you know, this would just be another field in Cheshire. And it's put Cheshire on the map, it's put Manchester on the map.
Yeah, I mean, I actually did find it quite touching. And I films like that, and when you kind of see the desire for knowledge and things like that, it almost kind of makes me well up. Did you kind of get that when you were like the noble intentions of Bernard Lovell, just kind of setting up radio antenna in a Cheshire field to look at the stars?
Yeah, there's something like really, I mean, he's just the kind of quintessential like plucky Brit. He just kind of gets on with stuff and like rolls his sleeves up. And I love all the archive of like the men in the fields wearing their suits, literally with their shirts rolled up, kind of like sticking metal into the ground. And there's like a little picture of Brian Lovell as a boy kind of like running around in a trench somewhere. And there's just something really, there's the kind of make do and mend kind of attitude of that sort of generation, which is really, really inspiring. And I think we should look back to those people as we do our own stuff now. And actually, what was really nice, I didn't realise, but in the back of the room during the film, there was four generations of Lovell's family who'd all seen the film. I think they'd seen it before on telly, but I'd never met them before. So it was like, you know, one of them, I think Bernard's granddaughter came up to me at the end and said that, you know, I really welled up during, you know, watching it. Because again, like, you think of these things as almost inhuman, like this sort of scientific endeavour, but actually what's behind this place and what's so special about Dodrell Bank is the human story behind it. And Bernard Lovell is a really inspiring figure and sort of stands for a generation of people that were hugely inspiring.
Definitely. Well, thanks for inviting us to come and see the film. And thanks for speaking to us today, Chloe. It's been an absolute pleasure.
That's all right. It was really fun.
So now I'm talking to Dr. Space Junk, otherwise known as Alice Gorman, from Flinders University in Adelaide. And she is a space archaeologist. That's a fantastic title. What actually is a space archaeologist?
So I'm an archaeologist, and I use archaeological methods and theories to apply to the objects of the space age, so everything that humans have sent out beyond the Earth. So this includes space junk in Earth orbit, planetary landing sites, deep space probes, but I do work on Earth too occasionally, so rocket launch sites, tracking stations, things like that as well.
And in your talk, you imagined what it would be like to be an alien explorer coming across our solar system. So what do you think aliens would make of our solar system?
I think they'd find it intriguing. I think they would look at our obsession with planets with solid surfaces and think that that was ridiculous. They'd wonder why we're not out in the middle and outer solar system more. So they'd say, where are all the orbital habitats? So in the future scenario, I imagine, there's no space stations in Earth orbit. They've all, you know, we've lost the capacity to sustain life in Earth orbit long ago. But there's no other space stations in the rest of the solar system either. So, you know, you don't have to build a settlement on the surface of a planet. We could just send out orbital habitats and do all of our studies of the rest of the solar system like that. So I think alien archaeologists would be saying, hey, look, what a depauperate suite of space technologies they have. Where's all the other stuff?
And how long would aliens have to come and sort of investigate our solar system before all traces of humanity was gone?
It's going to vary a lot planet to planet. So some planets and moons have, you know, far more corrosive or complicated environments than some. So the moon's pretty good. No atmosphere, no water, very little seismic activity. Venus isn't bad. So sure, we've got clouds of sulfuric acid and there's sulfuric acid rain, but it doesn't actually reach the ground. It's evaporated before the ground. No water, some seismic activity. So stuff on the surface there could likely survive for some thousands of years, maybe even longer. On some of the moons, yeah, that stuff might be around for a while as well. I think Mars is looking not so great, just because it's very dynamic. We've got all these sandstorms. So I think that's going to wear away the material record. There's lots of stuff in orbit around different moons and planets as well, but those orbiters, when they run out of fuel, depending on what their orbit is, they're going to fall onto the surface too. So I think it's going to be a bit of a mixed bag. So if we don't send any more missions out into the solar system in the near future, probably the moon is going to be the place where the archaeological evidence of our space age will be the best preserved.
And there is so much stuff that we've sent out over the last couple of decades. Do you think that that's a problem with how much stuff we're leaving behind?
I kind of don't, because while I'm, you know, I like to think I'm as environmentally committed as the next person, that is literally what archaeologists do. We study junk people leave behind. So I want there to be stuff that is a record for us. And in fact, there are some interesting political dimensions to this. So they may be relevant in the near future, maybe less so in the far future. Let's just say there's a situation where one nation or one corporation is attempting to gain privileged access to the resources of some planet. This is the sort of thing that happens on Earth. They might go to the archaeological sites of another company or another nation and destroy them. And then they'll say, well, you weren't here. You have no right to use this resource. You say you're here, but where's the evidence? Where is it? Oh, you know, we just... So this happens on Earth. People use cultural heritage as political weapons. So it's not impossible this will happen in space as well. And this very stuff that we're thinking of just as junk is actually going to be used to establish evidence that there was a greater diversity of space players than we might see in the future when some private corporations come to dominate space. So heritage is important.
And we're actually standing under the shadow of the Lovell Telescope, which is a UNESCO World Heritage Monument. Do you think is being enough to being done to protect places like the Apollo landing sites, the rovers, even things like the New Horizons probe and the Voyager 2 probe?
Well, we're fortunate with things further out in the solar system, the likelihood of humans getting there anytime soon is, you know, it won't be soon, it'll be a long, long time, and then we'd have to find them. That's the other thing. So they're probably safe. They're just protected by distance. What aliens will do if they find them, we can't control that. In terms of the inner solar system, look, you know, people are making a big fuss. I've heard the Director General of the European Space Agency say, oh, we can't heritage list everything on the moon. You wouldn't be able to go anywhere. And look, frankly, that's an ill-informed view. There's so few sites on the moon at this point in time. And there's a lot of moon. It's not a small place. So there is no reason right now why we have to touch or disturb anything. Nobody loses if we just leave those places alone. So it's going to be a matter of educating the space community that heritage is not the enemy. I mean, it's a very common attitude on Earth. But we don't need to import, as with many earthly attitudes, you don't need to import them into space as well. So the short answer to that is no, not enough is being done. But I'm available for consultation for a certain fee.
And there is also a huge variety of stuff that's been left out there. What's your sort of favourite or most unusual artefact that's been left behind by humanity?
That really, it's such a hard question to answer. This is a cliche, but I'm very, very fond of Voyager 2. So there were two Voyagers launched in 1977. Voyager 1 got outside the solar system first, and it's the one people tend to make a fuss about. I'm very fond of Voyager 2 because it only left the solar system in the last year. So it's you know, someone had already done it, people got less excited about it. But just like Voyager 1, it carries a golden record, so the famous golden records. On the golden records, there are two pieces of Aboriginal music. And in a little piece of research I did some time ago, I found out who the musicians were. Their names were Jara, Mudpo and Wally Paru. And it just makes me feel, I don't know, it makes me feel strongly to think that there is Aboriginal culture that far out in the solar system. So that's Voyager 2, and the golden records are my favourite space artefact.
I do think it is important with stuff like that that it's not just the major spacefaring nations that are out there. The entire of humanity is represented out in space. Now, looking a bit closer to Earth, there is a bit of a problem with some of the stuff that we've been left behind, particularly space junk in low Earth orbit. Do you think that that's going to be a problem that we're going to have to really start considering over the next couple of years?
Yeah, and people have been saying this for maybe, I think the first consideration that this stuff would be both junk and problematic is in the late 1970s. So it's not like this is a new problem. But, you know, people keep just setting it to one side, putting their head in the sand. It requires international cooperation. It also requires, we've had a few instances of particular nations deciding to test their ground-based weaponry on stuff in Earth orbit, even though they know it's going to create a massive new amount of space debris. So we need to stop that from happening. We probably need to get some, you know, Elon Musk could, instead of sending thousands of satellites up to give people internet they didn't necessarily ask for, he could put his resources into finding active solutions for removing some of this debris. The technology we have to do this so far is rudimentary. There have been a couple of successful tests. People keep talking about it, nothing's happening. So it is a problem. It is going to have to be resolved probably with some kind of international agreement, I would say, in the next decade, or we are not in a good situation.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time out of your day to talk to us, Alice.
An absolute pleasure. Thank you.
So that's it for another episode of Radio Astronomy and indeed another year at Blue Dot Festival. I just want to say thanks to the festival organisers and indeed the staff here at Jodrell Bank for having us for another year. If you've been interested and inspired by our discussions about Apollo 11, you can find out more about the space race and indeed the future of lunar exploration in our August issue. But for me, Inez, that's it for another year. Thanks very much for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Jack Bateman and Ben Hewitt. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or simply head to iTunes.